Welcome back to part two of our episode with Travis Green from Let Us Talk Books. In this part of the episode, we talk about foreign policy, biblical interpretation, and Black American Christianity from slavery all the way up to Creflo Dollar. This is a really funny and interesting part of the conversation, and we're sure that you'll enjoy it just as much as the first. Here you go. No, this is kind of a fun question for you, Travis, that converges a lot of the things we're talking about, because you're saying it's really important point. You have to be curious about why folks believe what they believe. But on like a U.S. foreign policy level, how do you think that kind of like communication can really be implemented, right? So it's like if we were talking with Iraq, like going back in time, like could we sit down and like say like, why do you believe this? What is made you to think? Why did you all build nukes? Any of this? I mean, they would ask us the same like the same thing. I feel like this also undoes Hitchens' argument a little bit for me, because it's like any time any empire intervenes in another empire, they are subconsciously saying that my morals are better than yours. I know what's right for you. You don't. And there's no asking of that question. Why do you believe what you believe? Does it work for you? America assumes, right, that democracy, that a republic, everything. And Hitchens uses those very words in his book, are best for everyone, every culture, no matter what. That it's cost us a lot of lives, a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of war, without ever asking that question, right? So how would you implement it, or think about implementing it on that scale, if it's possible?
Man, that. Oh, that's a
great. That's a fun question, bro.
Oh, that is. That really is.
You asked the right person.
Oh, man. Partially because I know.
Exactly.
I have an in-depth knowledge of what is called the National Defense Strategy, and the National Security Strategy. So, for those of you who don't know, the National Security Strategy is a three-pillar system that is presented by the President of the United States that discuss what the security measures for the United States will be. The National Defense Strategy is pushed out by the Department of Defense from the Secretary of Defense, that is pretty much a subsidiary of how the Department of Defense is going to execute the initiatives of the President. So with that kind of contextual knowledge in mind, America in general is used to being diplomatic with the sole purpose of advancing United States interests. Do those interests typically conflict with other countries? Yes, obviously, right? The main two right now are the large geopolitical contenders, adversaries of China and Russia. So could the concepts in the book be used in that kind of geopolitical context? I believe so, but on a smaller scale, right? Where you can have world leaders get together and have small, minute conversations that could possibly potentially lead to agreement and compromise on larger issues like climate change legislation, human rights violation issues within the UN. But if we don't do the small fundamentals things right, I don't think we ever get to the large issues, right? Which goes back to your point about Iraq was, hey, what could we have done to prevent the massive loss of life that occurred because we wanted to invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam Hussein? At that juncture, I don't believe there was anything that we could have done as far as the concepts in the book to kind of like talk President Bush and Tony Blair off the ledge of doing that. But I think that after the initial invasion, we could have had those small, minute conversations over and over to say, hey, we might not need to be here this long, or hey, we're spending a lot of money occupying with no clear objectives or strategic outcomes in mind. But in order for us to get to that point in a foreign policy aspect, we just have to be good at the fundamental aspects of just talking to other people ourselves. Like if we can't talk to, like Jan was saying, our family members at a Thanksgiving dinner, I don't think we can talk to a world leader about economic policy.
Facts.
Conversations are conversations, no matter what they're about. A conversation about what you're getting to eat tonight is honestly the same thing as, hey, can we put this embargo on this country to heighten or dismiss the global chip shortage for vehicles?
Right.
Their conversations are all the same. We're all human. But in order to do that, we have to come to the realization that, hey, we have certain things that we need to talk to other people about, and we can't get there if we don't have hard, impossible conversations with other people.
Wow. That's amazing. And that your whole point, though, kind of made me think, too, like the unfortunate reality is if all three of us, like while talking here in this podcast, had like a little red button in the corner of our desk that could send nukes to the other person, like it would feel like a much different convo, right? But that's literally what these world leaders have. Like, when you are afraid of like, and always thinking about the chess, like the chess moves that the other person's gonna make. And right, because they all have this button, the conversations can never be this level of like candor. I think it is frankly impossible. Like, imagine if all three of us were in person trying to talk about God and we all had like AKs, strapped with AKs. It's a much different convo than if we don't have the weapons. But that's basically what the world leaders are doing anytime that they're talking. It's like the looming threat at all times of like, we will like destroy you and like everything that you love.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Yeah, I was thinking of it totally differently, that the looming threat is that, like, you know, if you're Xi Jinping, like, you don't have to worry about term limits in the same way that like Trump and Biden do. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Like if I'm somebody who's like chilling in that sense, like you're coming to me with stuff, I'll be like, all right, I can hold out, you know, I can wait 6 years until you're gone. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that's part of the, I don't know. I obviously the specific world leaders themselves, they're not, you know, handcuffed to the briefcase all the time, to the football, you know, with the button. Like they definitely do maintain a decent level of like, oh, how are your kids doing? Like, you know, having like, you know, decent interaction. Of course, you know, that what you're pointing out is a big part of it, Miles, but I think like we've been saying, right, there are always other factors going into it as well, which includes that given that you do have to, you know, at that level, interact with people who are in completely different like geopolitical organizations, right, and situations, like, you know, that changes it too, right? Just off of your long-term sense of like, oh, do I really need to be cool with this person if they're going to be gone?
So I mean, like, everybody, like, those both of y'all brought up two great points. Is like, one, Miles is like, there's this overwhelming threat of violence when we have hard conversations, but then we also have, like you said, Jan, this like kind of confluence of factors that all go into having those conversations as well. So I mean, it's because I'm wondering, because I have it all the time, where though I might not have a feeling of violence perpetuated toward me, I do have kind of like an overarching thing of, if I express how I feel, then there could be detrimental consequences to what I say. To kind of give you an example is, hey, if I talk to an individual that I'm fairly I'm fairly, I mean, agree with on a lot of things, but then I come across something that they think about, let's just say religion, you know, since we're talking about it, right? And I give them the hard truth that I don't believe in the God that they believe in. Could that potentially ruin our working relationship or our friendship or whatever other relationship that I have with this particular individual? I think that's kind of a lesser form of violence, but also a factor as well, right? Same thing can be said with any other social issue. Hey, if I express my belief about Black Lives Matter, the abortion debate, gun control, gun legislation, healthcare, whatever, could there be a chance that somebody shuts me out of our relationship or working friendship or otherwise? I think that's like something that should be in the back of our mind, but we have to get past that. I mean, I think we should get past that.
Wow. I mean, you're kind of speaking to something that Miles and I were talking about a few weeks ago. We were having a heart to heart about just like how afraid we are to, like, you know, lose a connection or to not make one off of like being honest all the time. Mm-hmm. And you just really spoke to that. 'Cause I mean, particularly for us, you know, growing up how we did, it was kind of like, oh, you know, you don't want to, we know that it sucks to lose friends. So it's like, if you're going to be honest about something and then it potentially means that you're losing a friend just off of like your beliefs, like that's a hard way to go, you know? Yeah. So then it's like, oh, do you say anything at all? Or do you kind of like find a way around it? I don't know. I mean, we're definitely at the point now where as we're, you know, learning how to not only like understand what we're feeling, but communicate that. We're just kind of like navigating the uncertainty and seeing where it goes. But that is definitely a real fear, right? Because, you know, you don't want to, given that you do cherish the relationships around you, you don't want to like do anything that could potentially harm them. But it's also about recognizing that like the harm is always going to be there to some extent, right?
Yeah. Have y'all lost anybody because of any beliefs that y'all have?
No.
Not yet, at least.
Not that I know it. Because like, no, this is a really funny story, Travis, that you will appreciate given everything we're talking about. But basically, my freshman year, I had a friend that was going to a Republican speaker event, and Candace Owens was there. And basically, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Ends up that I'm in a photo with like the college Republicans group at the end of the night, you know, supporting my friend. And right, like within a couple of days, like I didn't even know like the photo was posted, anything. I didn't care because like, but I'm like posing in the photo with Candace Owens and everything. And within a couple of days, like everyone's like, "Is Miles a Republican?" Like, oh God, like I didn't know. Like that's crazy. Like, and I was like, "Oh no, everyone chill." Like I'm not. Like I was just there. But it's like, how do I can't like blank out the photo. And it's a really funny photo because I'm like not smiling either. I look really serious and kind of scary.
Like, why am I here?
Exactly. But, I got stuck. But right, I think like low key, like, even thinking about that, like. In times where I couldn't even explain myself to someone or someone wasn't even willing to hear my side of the story. Like, I honestly think from that alone, I probably lost a couple potential acquaintances, friendships, but right. With folks that were not understanding at all, do I even want them as friends? Probably not. Like they're not the right or dies. They're not the folks I would have these interesting combos with at all. So right, I mean, college in general for me, like I think I did have to learn that I couldn't talk about politics in the way that I wanted to all the time. College especially, I think, was just a very intolerant place of like any other view. Again, don't like their beliefs questioned, challenged, even in the slightest. Yeah, like college, like general, I think folks were very on edge about losing friends and making sure everything that they said was wrapped in a bow.
Yeah, that's kind of sad to me, because I would assume that college is the place where you come together, have tons of ideas that like you want to talk about, you want to formulate how you feel about the world, how you think about the world, rationalize how you came to that conclusion. Yep. If you kind of, oh, I hate this term, cancel people before they even get to that, and how are you going to be able to discuss that in the boardroom when you're in charge of somebody?
Yep.
How are you going to be able to discuss that in your political life if you're running for office? Like, if you can't formulate your opinions and your thoughts and your processes there, where else can we do that at?
Yep. No, and that was low-key like the point of this podcast, like the point of Jen and I reading books all these years is like, we had to realize that this was necessary. Like, we were not going to be able to learn everything that we wanted to learn just in school. Like, you do have to go out of your way to like put yourself in front of these ideas. That is why, as Jen was saying, like, I didn't care. I read every Republican book, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens. I read it all because, like, at the end of the day, I know like their points. Are there tweets on social media that get folks mad? That is not like their encompassing worldview. And I'm right, like, it is easier and it feels like I'm like sitting to have a coffee with them if in a book length they like explain where they're coming from, and you can just like empathize more. You don't have to agree, but you understand that they're humans too, like the way that they grew up. Everything that happened in their life, like, led them to believing what they believe now. And that could have been you, you know? And
yeah, I think there's a perfect quote in How to Have Impossible Conversations that I think sums that up, is like, hey, the mark of an educated mind is one that can understand the concept without agreeing with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the same way. Right. So I have plenty of books on my shelf that most people would probably tell me I have to burn. Like, I have Mein Kampf on my shelf.
Wow.
I have plenty of books by Dr. Thomas Sowell. I have books by a litany. I have books by a litany of people that like I don't agree with. Like, I probably, to be honest with you, I probably have more Bibles on my shelf than Christians. Just be honest with you. Like, I have no less than like 12 Bibles on my shelf, probably like 5 Korans, a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, and a couple of other holy texts. And
wait, hold on. How did that happen, Travis?
he's a collector.
It's like, wait, hold on.
Well, it's funny because
he's like one less book out in the world.
So the Bible collection was honestly, I got into a thing where I wanted to like look at the different interpretations of specific verses. Jeez, so if you like, for example, one of my favorite chapters, or let me not say chapters because I don't want to offend anybody, guys. One of my favorite gospels to read is Mark, the Gospel of Mark. And I wanted to see what the difference between the King James Version versus the NIV versus the NRSV. I wanted to see the translation differences. And then if you look in the margins of most Bibles that are printed now, you'll see, especially with Mark, from chapter 16, verse 9 and later, there's a footnote in the margins that says, the earliest manuscripts does not have the rest of this gospel. It is interpretation after the fact. And for those who don't know, the chapter ends, the original chapter of Mark ends with the tomb being open and nothing being in there, and that's it. There's no like resurrection experience. There's nothing after the tomb being open, right? But most people don't know that if you don't look at the footnote in the Bible. And I wanted to see
footnotes in the Bible. Wait, what?
Just like
actually,
yeah. There's if you go pick up a Bible, any Bible right now. If you were to go to the front of each chapter, especially in the Gospels, just go to Mark or Matthew, right? Each chapter begins with a little note that says, these names are not attributable to the people who actually wrote it. It is church tradition.
Right now.
Yeah. Don't take my word for it. Just go look at it for yourself.
You got the Bible right there, bro.
Yeah.
Let's see.
And you'll see it. If yours is like mine, Miles, you'll see the footnotes are in the middle. And then if you look at the beginning of the chapter will have an asterisk either at the top or at the bottom. And it'll say this gospel was attributed to this individual. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was written by this individual.
Wow.
Which is, I thought was interesting, but that was the same thing that happened to me when I picked up other holy texts like the Quran. So like I got one gifted to me by an individual when I was in Iraq. He was one of my first interpreters when I deployed to Iraq. So I got a couple of holy Qurans, the Bhagavad Gita, and a whole bunch of other things, right? But the basis is like you would assume that I'm one of those things, but no, I'm not. I'm just like I want to understand why people believe the way they believe. Same thing with the Thomas Sowell books. Like, I mean, if you don't read them, then how do you understand or how do you get into a space to talk to people who might hold conservative views? Or even on the other spectrum, if you're a conservative, how do you get to talk to people that have whole liberal views if you don't engage and talk with people about those things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think at the end of the day, though, like three of us are pretty rare cases. Cause I think, right, like human beings are lazy. Like, I don't even think Thomas Sowell, like, and I've read several of his books too. I think he's a clear writer, interesting, even though I don't agree with him on everything. Right, like, he's very partisan too, very one-sided. Like he doesn't really have the same like empathy, and like I'm sure that he's read, you know, other books that he doesn't agree with, but right, like folks do like to just choose their side, stick with it, and find all the arguments for just their side. Like you're the rare case of an atheist too, I guess, other than Hitchens that I've heard, like, really tries to study like other holy texts. Like, that's amazing. But right, you know that, right, there is no side really. It's like, I'm a human, I'm trying to understand how other humans think.
Yeah, so I would honestly, Miles, I would say, and this is again, this is generalizing, but I would venture to say that most atheists that I know and I interact with on a daily basis know more about the Bible than most American Christians. I would make that claim.
That's a great argument.
And
to see that,
I would just hear me out on this one, guys.
Yeah.
The first one that I always talk about, because I always talk about Bible contradictions as one of the paths that led me to not believing that the Bible is true, was the comparisons of the Gospels themselves. So some years ago, I took a Great Courses course, which is a great resource for anybody who just wants to learn something about a topic, by a professor named Bart Ehrman. I have a couple of his books on my Instagram page, which I suggest everybody read. He's one of the most eminent New Testament scholars out. He wrote a whole bunch of about the New Testament. He learned three separate languages just to translate and read the Bible in his original text.
That's wild.
One of his great courses has a PDF that lines out the Gospels, all four of them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and compares stories. And you could see the differences in the narratives from each story. One of the differences, for example, is, I don't know if many people know this, the birth narrative of the virgin birth was only in two Gospels.
Oh, wow.
So it was only in Matthew and Luke. It wasn't stated in Mark, and it wasn't stated in John. Also, the time of day that Jesus died was different in John than it was in Mark.
Wow.
It's yeah. funny, like, I looking back on these small, yeah. minute details that you're like, all right, I learned this in Sunday school when I was a kid, but like I kind of glossed over, right? Another contradiction that people say a lot, I don't know if y'all have been exposed to this last seven sayings of Jesus on the cross, but if you look at each gospel, the last sayings aren't all together. Each gospel has him saying something different as he died. So if you look in Mark's gospel, he said that was the only gospel that says, my God, why have you forsaken me, in the original Hebrew, which is Elohim, Eloi. I forget the Hebrew because I'm not as good at Hebrew as other things. And then if you go to John, John has this like confident, like boastful Jesus saying, all right, it is finished. So which one did he say? Like, do we know for a fact what he said? No, there was no camcorders. There was only after the fact translations of texts that were written 40 years after his supposed death.
Wow.
So
yeah. And then on top of that too, like there were several, you know, meetings of all the top, what's the word, like priests or whoever, who, you know, would go through and like take out parts of the books and be like, like this shouldn't go into like the final version of the Bible. Like it happened several times, you know? And I mean, honestly, like I remember we did a confirmation, and that was really important just for being able to go into a mosque, go into a temple, and, you know, just feel what it's like, you know, existing within the space of another religion. But they also took us through the history of like the Bible and all that stuff. And I will say that when they were like, you know, the Bible or those stories weren't written until like 40, 50, 100 years after, they edited over the stories several times. I was like, wait, are y'all trying to like get us to think that this is like not real? Cause that was my first impression. I was like, wait, are you telling me that like so much of this book has been like edited out to like look the way it does now, you know, like how much of this is actually true? That's the man-made point, right?
Yeah. So like Dr. Ehrman does a great job at actually spelling that out. So there's one book on my Instagram that I actually suggested to an individual who jumped in my DMs and wanted to like kind of like excoriate me for posting some less than admirable things about religion, right? So I sent him a book free of charge, and he DM'd me back and was like, thank you, like I haven't heard this information before, I never knew this information, I'm gonna look into it a little bit more. And we now hold like pretty genuine conversations about why he believes what he believes, his Nigerian upbringing in America, and how his parents kind of like forced Christianity on him, you know, those things. But if I didn't have the ability to just say, okay, if you believe that, all right, here's why I believe what I believe, I'm gonna send you something, I don't think we would have gotten to that point of him saying, all right, I'm not totally where you're at, but I can meet you in the middle.
You sent him that Jesus Interrupted?
I sent him Jesus Interrupted. I also sent him Zealot. And there was one more that I sent him. I think it was Forged, which was one of the first books by Dr. Ehrman that I had read, which was going to your point, Jan, was, all right, there's plenty of books in the Bible that were written, rewritten, stuff's taken out, stuff put is put back in, mistranslated. Like, my favorite mistranslation is the virgin birth, which in the original Greek was translated from a Hebrew word, alma, which means young woman. It doesn't actually mean virgin. It just means young woman. So is this whole like virgin birth narrative something just that occurred out of some mistake? Possibly. So now we have a whole Christmas celebration celebrating the birth of a supposed savior that was probably because some scribe got lazy and tired.
Hold on, Travis, how much time you got, bro? Because this is what I was just thinking about with, I was just thinking about this with Christianity in particular, though, because as obviously, you know, the missionary zeal, you know, traveled, not only did it take over Europe, but then it went on to, you know, be a part of Christianizing the dark continent of Africa and the Americas, right? Like, at every point along the way, there was so much like syncretism that had to happen in order for people to be cool with like accepting Christianity, right? I mean, I was just reading a book called Orisha's Something and Goddesses. Wait, let me check this. Lilith Dorsey. Orisha's Goddesses and Voodoo Queens, divine feminine in African spirituality. But she talks about how so many of the pantheon of, you know, West African religions were kind of like, they just put on a new costume. They adapted themselves into Christianity so that people could continue to believe in their religions and like make it look like they were believing in Christianity when they really weren't, you know? I mean, the whole idea of Christmas, I was reading at a museum in DC, the National Museum of the American Indian. They were talking about the importance of Dia de los Muertos, right? Day of the Dead, and how in order for Christians to make some sort of appeal to people that believed in the Day of the Dead, they just moved it right next to All Saints Day. And that's what Halloween is. And it's just how much of this, you know, so much of this is a conversation, not only between like Christians themselves, but Christians and like people of all other different countless religions around the world. And it has evolved so much and changed just with like every person that has encountered it that was coming in with like a different perspective.
Yeah, man. I think that's, we could talk about this all day.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh man. So I'll talk about your point because I think it leads to something that I think we all as Black Americans need to understand too, right? Is when our ancestors were captured and enslaved from the banks of West Africa and brought to the shores of America, do you truly believe that every one of them were or believed in Christianity? No, absolutely not, right? So what was the one way to domesticate a peoples that needed to be enslaved? Was to give them a book that said, hey, look, your life is hard here right now, but after you die, you'll get your eternal reward. You'll give them a book that says in Ephesians, slaves obey your earthly masters. Like, if you utilize that type of tenet to, one, degrade a workforce and enslave people, we need to have that larger conversation with the African-American public. Is like, hey, why do we believe this? Why is the majority of Black Americans Christian? Or do we believe it? Or are we Christians because it's true? Or are we Christians because of a historical, socio-political route that made the majority of Black Americans Christian, right? Because I think it's a multitude of those factors, right? It goes into all those things you said, like, hey, we need to understand that slaves were brought Christianity to make them servile. But then the civil rights movement, that large block of the 50s and 60s and even early 70s, our leaders who push for our full emancipation and full civil rights and equality in America were largely church leaders. Like, we can't divorce Martin Luther King and Malcolm X from their religion. It would just be like ridiculous to. Malcolm X was who he was because he believed in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and he believed in the tenets of Islam. Dr. King was who he was because he believed Christianity was true. So how can we have that nuanced conversation to say, hey, the doctrine that they believe in my opinion, it's not true, but did they do great things because of it? And I think, yes, they did do great things because of it. But I think there's so much more to that conversation if we can have it. But in order to have the conversation, we have to be open to actually having it.
Yeah, I think that question, again, is provoked so well by the autobiography of Malcolm X, because, right, he talks about how Christianity is, right, slave religion, all this. But I really think now, like, even thinking about you and your mom, us and our parents, and almost all Black Americans that I know now in relation to their parents are, in general, less religious. And it feels like there's like this kind of divergence happening in the Black community where, right, because especially Generation Z has been indoctrinated with the internet, with this kind of idea of tolerance on a global scale, and like really caring about identity all these ways, like we are kind of stepping into a new cultural inheritance in a bit. And right, like what was being passed down as like this absolute way to make sure that like morals and ethical standards in our community were intact, we're realizing that we like kind of don't need it in the same way. Like honestly, what the church was for our parents' generation, it's sad to say, but I think it's almost found greater in something like Black Twitter. Like folks actually like see that as a community. We're right. They can be their truest self. So yeah, I definitely see that divergence happening. That question that you're talking about happening with our generation and just our age.
I think, and I want to get y'all's opinion on this too. Mm-hmm. Is I feel the same way. I think religion and its importance in our society is waning. Mm-hmm. To me, I think that's a great thing. To others, probably less so. Because I honestly think that, like, hey, we have rethought our beliefs and we have come to the conclusion that, like, hey, we don't have to hate gay people because a book tells us so. We don't have to hate other people because a book tells us so. But I think there's a confluence of factors that go into like why the younger generation doesn't believe the things that their parents believe. I know specifically just with myself, I don't believe the things that my mom believes just because I don't believe the things actually happen. Like, cause I want to know what's true. Mm-hmm. But again, I also have to remind myself that for her and the previous generation, the church was a safe space from the ills that America put on Black people. So I have to be empathetic to that. I have to be empathetic to know that if I speak to an older Black American who grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that was their place to get away from discrimination. was to go to a place with all Black people. Though the doctrine that was preached was not true, it was a place to get away from being called a nigger on the street. Mm-hmm. It was a place to get away from saying that it was a colored only bathroom, all those things. So I have to be empathetic to that portion. It's just it's an interesting concept to think about, because I don't, just to me, and I'll just speak my opinion on this one. I believe that things like you said, Black Twitter, a whole bunch of other methods have allowed younger Black Americans to replace what the Black church was mm-hmm. to Black Americans now. So now we can reach out via the internet and find community. We can reach out in our local community and find togetherness. Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily need that kind of thing that the church gave Black Americans back then.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like the reliance on religion being positive or negative. I don't know. I see it more as neutral. It's just development. It's just change. We have no idea about the long-term consequences of it. In my mind, though, like in thinking about organizing, like MLK, like Malcolm, and even thinking about Black music and what the church did for the last half century of Black music, like, is unbelievable. Like, the amount of artists came out of the church, singers, the entire tradition is based in the church. And, right, all those cultural runoffs, like, you would have never known from, right, whenever the first Black church started in America, right? And so even thinking about that organizing power, that musical cultural power, I also am like worrisome of, right, that like we also don't have that same, we have the same organizing ability over the internet, but I don't think it's the same like dedication and the same togetherness.
Yeah.
Because like so many folks can organize their own marches, their own things, whatever. And like, oh, I disagree with you on this little point, so we're gonna do a different one. It's like, I feel like that could be more prevalent. And I see the runoff of that being
a little more separate.
That is a hypothesis given how I look back on what the Black church has done, you know, in the last half century.
That's an amazing point, because I go back and forth about this all the time. Like, I still listen to Yolanda Adams and Kirk Franklin myself. Like, hey, I can't get away from good music. Good music is good music no matter what it is, right? That's so true. But I honestly would love y'all's opinion on this, because in my discussions with people, just in my life online and all over the place, right? And let me see if I can formulate this question in a great way, is would you give up the church, the negative aspects of the Black church, knowing that the positive aspects are also going to go along with it, i.e. do you give up a huckster like Creflo Dollar, Eddie Long, and the mega church scam? Do you give that up, that big negative,
right,
knowing that you're not going to get the great music like Yolanda Adams, Aretha Franklin, Kirk Franklin, all these great artists, the Winans, like, would you give that up in order to get rid of the real negative?
This is what Thomas Sowell too says, you know, I don't want to bring him back up, but right, he says there are only trade-offs, there are no solutions. And that's why I see our less reliance on religion as a Black community now, like, it's neutral, like, we have no idea. But would I want the trade-off to be as exact as you make it out to be? Like, Totally. Like, I wish we could keep all the good, take away the bad, but the bad is around the corner. It's invisible. You don't know what it is yet, but whenever it comes, we're gonna regret it and resent it too, right? So,
yeah, and even in the larger American point too is like, I even ask people who aren't of Black descent this question all the time. Like I just had a conversation with a coworker who was Catholic, and I asked him the same similar question. It was like, hey, would you want the Catholic Church as an organization to go away if it meant freeing the victims of childhood sexual abuse? Knowing that the Catholic Church also is one of the largest contributors of charity in the United States. Like, what are you willing to trade off for that? Mm. And I think the Black Church is something similar to that. It's like, do you want to get rid of a T.D. Jakes, who I just saw his net worth. I think his net worth is like, what is it, like 25 million?
Wow, you got to start a church.
Oh yeah, yeah. If you want to get rich, yeah, let's make some money.
Joel Osteen level, bro.
Oh man,
Jakes level. Joel Osteen.
Oh god.
Yeah. If we want to make some money, that's the quickest way.
Yo.
Oh man, I don't even think I can answer that question.
No, I think that's a very valid critique, right? It's like, right, Jesus is saying, you know, all this give to those who are meek. You know, he's living a much different lifestyle than these pastors are. It's like, you know, that's part of my doubt too about it. Like, even being a self-identified Christian, like, it's like, what is that about really? Like, do you really need all that? Like, who are you trying to flex on? You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's supposed to be.
But nah, though, I would say that you'd kind of need the big house and the 10 cars in order to justify. because then you're living testament of the power of prayer and the power of belief, right? And like, you believe it, you pray, you work hard, like, and you'll be blessed, right? I think, I feel like that just goes to show how like malleable religion is and spiritual beliefs are when it has everything to do with like the material that you can see as it does with the intangible, right? I mean, like so much, yeah, the entire prosperity gospel is off of like believing. It's not so much about, you know, acting exactly as Jesus did. It's just believing that Jesus exists, right? And that he died on the cross for you. And then that's, I mean, you're golden. You have full permission to do whatever you want. And I think that just kind of goes to show as well how from, you know, from even the difference between, you know, farmers kind of like having more of an attraction to Christianity, or Christianity having more of an attraction to farmers, versus like shepherds and people that are more nomadic having more of an attraction to Islam, right? Like there are very clear ways in which religion kind of like shapes itself in a way to benefit whatever it is that you're already doing, rather than like really challenge it. But I guess that like how much of that is dependent on the person themselves, or the religion, I don't know. Like when you say, I kind of see what you're saying about religion being neutral, but I've also come to believe that nothing is neutral in the sense that it's always doing something. So maybe it's like, maybe what you mean is that, or how I'm interpreting what you mean is that like, it's impossible to know if it's like a net positive or net negative, but that doesn't mean that's not doing anything, right? I mean, to Travis's first point about religion being like a great way of organizing like mass groups of people, like money does the exact same thing, right? You know, you think about Homo sapiens, Yuval Noah Harari's books, right? Like he talks about just stories being that way of mobilizing large groups of people. And, you know, what is the Bible and the Quran and Torah, everything, a collection of stories, right? So, I mean, you know, even Seth Godin has said that money is a story, right? So I think just seeing how it's like fitting within just wherever people are at a given time and just their life and our relations to the environment is like particularly interesting to me.
My roommate and I last night were having an interesting conversation about why we believe there are so many like cult documentaries on Netflix. Like folks seem so interested in cults, and like, of course, it's a peripheral topic to religion and everything that we're talking about here. And right, because I think the real threat that we see with these mass groups are these people who are willing to blindly follow anything.
Ooh, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't matter if it's political party, religion, cult, anything. Right. And concerts. I made the point that it isn't the cult or the party or the religion that makes the people that way. Before they join, they are already zombies. Like they are already unthinking. Like, it's really just a matter of timing that any belief or group party is introduced to them, that they are willing to accept it as the end all be all because they are so zombified. So I wanted to ask, like, in your life, like, I feel like you are, again, a rare case of someone your age, who's like so willing and curious to learn about everything. I feel like at your age is when a lot of your peers are trying to just settle into their groups of, yep, this is my life. This is what I believe in. And kind of getting into that blind follower zombified state that I'm talking about. So like of your peers, of your age group, your generation, like what percentage do you think are in that kind of blind follower state that I'm talking about?
Oh man, it's an interesting question because I think we are blind followers of multiple different concepts, but not all in the same way, if that makes sense, right? So I'm gonna just quick shout out to Atlanta Braves. We got us one. So I'm a blind follower of all Atlanta sports teams.
Right.
I have no like justification why I do, other than I was born here. I mean, in that way, I am kind of a blind follower as well. But I think in that particular aspect, I'm also willing to admit that like I like the Falcons, the Braves, the Hawks, not because of some evidence-based reason, but because I am from Atlanta. Like that's my reason. And I know that. I think the problem and the issue with cults in general and things that have a detrimental effect to society is that when people follow cult leaders, and we can talk about religious cult leaders such as Jesus of Nazareth, Joseph Smith of the Mormon Church, Muhammad, or the Prophet Muhammad, and Islam and the like, is that in those aspects, you get a large group of people that can follow the doctrines and it's unquestionable, which is a detriment to society because if it's unquestionable, you can't have the conversation to begin with. And once you do have the conversation, those religions have like the self-protecting mechanism of ostracization or apostasy that says, hey, I'm going to ostracize you from our community for not falling in line with that belief, or I'm going to take you out from this world by violence for not believing the way that we believe. So it's a fine line between what belief is okay to have that's outside of the realm of rationality But what belief can you hold that affects other people? Which for me, one of those, or a compilation of those beliefs, are one, why do you believe what you believe in the political realm? For example, it's more than a couple years ago now, but I think it was 2012 that gay marriage was legalized throughout the United States, right? If we didn't have a large society built around this kind of Christian / Abrahamic faith of homosexuals not needing to be a human, I think we would have gotten to a place of equality a little bit faster. But then there's also modern time cults where I would describe hardline fundamentalist Trump supporters as a cult as well. I can't think of any other way to describe January 6th other than in terms of cults. I have no other way to describe it. If there is another way to describe it, I would love for somebody to educate me on how to describe it more accurately, but that's the most accurate description I can come to. But even other societal behaviors fall in line with that as well. It's like, hey, the whole, I guess cancel culture in such a bland statement is like, hey, we want to go back as far as we can to silence people who said one negative thing, which, I mean, that's just not leaving anybody room to grow right now, right? And that's kind of a cultist behavior. So how do we get out of being able to understand that, hey, when we can rally around a central idea, it's beneficial because it makes a glue for community, but you can't be so blindly committed to the ideal that you can't change the idea when you're presented with new good evidence, right? Because that's how we end up with flat earthers. That's how we end up with anti-vax people. And that's how we end up with a lot of things that are just negative for society as a whole, because we get rallied around this idea that we can't change.
The flat earthers, low key, man, like the anti-vaxxers, I think, you know, it's fine because, you know, sure, the jury's still out, but the flat earthers, I'm like, bro, Copernicus, man, figure that out, like, half a moment ago, bro. What are you saying, bro? Like,
I've always looked at them as just trolls, bro. Like, I don't know if they even believe it. It's just like the ability to say, oh, yeah, I believe in like flat
earth. Well, it's funny because it's along the same lines. Because that, like, yes, the jury's still out on what the COVID-19 vaccine is going to do for our society, but then at the same time, it's like, all right, what? Why do you believe? Like, because I talk with people about the vaccine all the time too. That's one another tough conversation to have, right? Why do you believe? Like, what was one conversation I had? Oh, the vaccine is a method of government mandated control. Like, why do you believe that? What is your evidence that led you to that conclusion? Like, how did you come to that conclusion? And if I were to present you with some evidence, what evidence would change your mind? Like that type of conversation. But it arises from that cultist behavior that you talked about, Miles. Was like, hey, like, we're kind of like evolved to be prone to cultist behavior because we rally around our group. Right. I mean, you can see it at any football game, basketball game. Like, you get around, let's see, I think the most obnoxious fans are Dallas Cowboys fans. You get around Dallas Cowboys fans, and there's nothing that you could say to them that doesn't make them believe that the Dallas Cowboys are the greatest team to ever walk the earth. So,
yeah. You know, I mean, hey, I was, what was it? I just got engaged over the summer, and like that first week of like celebration was hilarious because we were basically on like off the weed gummies the entire week, and it was so it was so much fucking fun. But we went to a Cubs game, like Chicago Cubs, and I haven't watched sports like since I was playing them. You know, I was like really kind of off it for a minute. Given that my fiance is a pro volleyball player, like volleyball is really the only thing I would watch, except with the exception of like boxing every once in a while. But there was something so special about being high at a baseball game where I was like, wow, like I was like, is this people's like community? Because I was like, because I was feeling it, and I wasn't even a Cubs fan. I didn't know anybody on the team or anything, but just like looking and seeing all of these people here like enjoying their time together while also doing it over like playing the base, watching the baseball game. I was like, you know what? Like if, even if I don't really care for like the sport itself, like I felt like I was having a need fulfilled just by being around a lot of people like that are in the same place as me. I mean, I've never seen so many like Chicagoans in one place for sure. But I think that just goes to show kind of your point about like, you know, just being a fan of Atlanta teams because you're from Atlanta. It's like, that, yeah, there's something very clear in terms of that feeling that you get by aligning yourself with the larger group. And I think my question right now about communities that I'm interested in joining or communities that I'm interested in like creating is that, In the case of like sports, right, or religions especially, like I think it's no problem to want to like enjoy the community of the people who like believe similarly or like are rooting for the same team, rooted in the same place. But what I'm not okay with is like demonizing the other, right? Whether it's like another religion or even other teams, right? Where you can't even like be friends with somebody who's like a Dallas Cowboys fan, right? Because it's along the lines of what we're talking about with political parties too. But I just think about what does it take to have the community aspect and like have that really that need fulfilled in that sense, but also be totally open and respectful to people who like, you know, aren't interested in that group or have a group that seems to be like opposite to yours and whatnot. Because that seems to be like the real challenge for me with a lot of like with a lot of people in general, no matter what their like fanaticism is directed towards, right? Is that like it's one thing to appreciate the community feel that you get from it, but it's another to like destroy community for other people who disagree.
That's a great point, Jan. Let me broach this concept with y'all. So I read this book, I reread this book recently that kind of hit along the same lines. So Jonathan Haidt wrote a book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided Over Politics and Religion. And in it, he describes kind of his hypothesis about why we're so tribal, why we're prone to that tribalism that you talked about. And his hypothesis was like, hey, our ancestors, when they banded together over a common ideal, they were more able to get resources from other rival bands that didn't have that ability to band together like that. So we're the byproduct of the evolutionary role of people gathering together around a central idea, no matter if it was true or not, and conquering other people who didn't have that same ability. So now we live in a space where the tribalism instinct is kind of second nature to us, whereas the ability to not demonize the other is harder for us because it wasn't evolved in our species. So I think that's the real important reason why we need to have impossible conversations, because that inbred, evolved sense of demonizing other people in order to survive, we really don't need it anymore. We're not on the African savannah anymore where we're competing for resources. We're sitting here on a chat via technology that most people in the 19th century would think was magic, talking to other people. And then once we end the chat, we're going to get up, walk down to a refrigerator, get something to eat, and then go drive somewhere or hop on a transit somewhere or Uber somewhere. Like, we don't have the computer resource, so we have the ability to talk to other people without demonizing them. But I think that's the hard part, is we want to demonize other people because it's some characteristic within us. But the difficult part is, hey, we don't have to do that anymore. We have the ability to, one, be kind and empathetic to other people and talk to them about why they believe what they believe, and hopefully change some bad ideas. Like I was talking about earlier with the musician Daryl Davis, who has had the ability to sit down with multiple KKK members and change their mind about Black people, Jewish people, and other people that they despise in general. Like, that's where I hope we can get to.
What about the folks that still live on the African savanna, though? Still in Toronto. Oh, man. Don't have a fridge. They don't have Zoom. They can't just drive away in their truck.
Oh, man.
We're all from Africa. No, it was that Daryl Davis story was so funny, especially that he like collected the hoods of everyone that he like converted. I was like, oh wow, it's kind of a weird shrine to have in your house. Like, oh, those are my Klansmen hoods, you know.
Like my trophy hoods.
Yeah,
trophy
hoods. I mean, that's a crazy trophy, bro. That it really is an amazing accomplishment, though, and like that's work that like no one wants to do at all. And I'm honestly really glad that he's been like willing to do that, because and like right, it's such a tangible and beautiful form of activism to like see folks like transform in front of your eyes. Like, you don't even have to do any of that. Like, he's not hired. Like, that's wild.
It's beautiful, but we got to take that first step. We got to be able to, hey, you might be across the political spectrum from me, you might be across the religious spectrum from me, or no religion at all, but we got to have the conversation. We have to be open to having the conversation all the time.
Yeah, here's another example too, to your first question all the way at the start of this conversation, was one time that Jen and I were like possibly worried about a conversation was our first one with you, Travis, because you liked talking to strangers, and we were like, why does he like this book? We were honestly thinking about it for so long, because we really didn't like it. Like, it was really like one of the first books that we really didn't like, and we were like, we just have no idea what this guy's explanation is going to be. And you defended it well. That was one of the first times I felt like my mind was really changed about a book, and like talking through it with someone. Like, that was beautiful too.
Yeah, no, totally. I was going to say too that's like during and after the conversation, I immediately knew that was like one of the greatest stories of the year for me.
Yeah.
Just that transformation, the surprise, the connection that we had in our first conversation, because, and it also, I mean, it was a huge like confidence boost as well. Just for this podcast, not even like myself individually, but just like this space and the power of like talking about books that are like meaningful to each other and to ourselves, because I for sure didn't like the book. And I remember going into it just being like, you know, like Travis, like, who knows, like Travis could like really surprise us with something, you know. And I think we had already had a sense of how people's stories around the books are like the most important part, right? But especially with like a book that I didn't like, for you to still have like these incredibly powerful stories still connect with you so well, I was like, man, like we can dislike the book and still make a friend out of it. We're like, what? We're like, can this podcast go wrong? Like, it's unclear, unclear so far, right? Because we definitely felt like, you know, you were a really special like connection that we made through the podcast. Even though, yeah, the particular book we disagreed on, but you know, here we are, right? And
I really appreciated the first conversation because it honestly, it helped me talk to even more people. Because as I started getting more active in the social media sphere in that space, people tend to question a lot of the beliefs that I hold, right? But the ability to just talk to people about it and like y'all said, is like the story around why they believe what they believe or the books that they love is the important part. Even in my conversations with people about my atheism is like, hey, why does he believe that way? And right. Does he want to do something good with it? That's vitally important for our discourse today. Is like, gotta have the conversation. We gotta have the impossible conversations, because honestly, I wouldn't have met y'all two brothers if I didn't just like, hey, reach out to y'all, like, hey, respond to a post about some books that y'all might not have agreed with. And if we weren't open to having the conversation about talking to strangers, right, we wouldn't have had this great connection we got.
Yeah,
for sure. I don't know if you remember the first time we talked was actually I DM'd you. Yeah, I think this is so beautiful, the way you set up your page. Like, you do put like intentionally different and provoking books on your page. And I think that is an amazing way for folks to like really live by like not judging a book by its cover. Like, you are putting out titles of like stuff that no one talks about in Bookstagram. And that's so important. Cause I was like, yeah, I first saw, I was like, whoa, like, I have to DM this guy. We have to talk, because I've never seen, right, someone have Christopher Hitchens and Thomas Sowell and Dick Gregory and Asada like all on their page. Like, that's
crazy mix.
But it means that they're willing to engage with all of those ideas, and that's a really really special person. You know, you're honestly just. I think, Travis, we definitely got to kick it whenever we come down south, or when Jan goes up to Bulgaria, whenever you're
well, no, yeah, you said you had to come through Germany, so I was like, yeah, oh, well, you know, I'm here.
Oh yeah, definitely.
we're the three of us can honestly like chop it up for like hours, probably about anything.
Oh yeah,
we have to do part three, part four, you know, honestly, you know, just always keep talking. Like, I learned so much from these combos. I definitely felt like we got in a flow state too. Like, seriously, like there was time here, I just lost track of time. I didn't even care. I was just like, we just talked.
Same thing happened last time too.
That's what I'm saying, bro.
Yeah. I appreciate y'all, brothers, man. Like, y'all been doing some good stuff, man. I love the previous podcast with Sol and George, man. Like, I love what y'all are doing, man.
Oh, you listen to it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, let's go.
Man, and I honestly love these conversations, man. Like, I told y'all before, I love seeing positive stuff like this. So it's amazing. It's amazing.
Nah, bro. It's you, bro. Thank you. Wait, yeah, we wanted to ask you too, man. Your IG page grown like so much. It's amazing. Like, how do you do it, bud? Tell us about the algorithm, bro.
Oh man. So it's funny. As soon as the interview hit, our first interview, I was pushing it out to everybody. Like, legit, like, I was like, hey, these are some great brothers. Don't listen to my interview. Listen to this one. Wow, hey, they got a professor from Georgetown. Like, it was funny because, like, I had literally shot out in some WhatsApp messages and GroupMe messages that I have with people I work with, like the episodes that I wasn't a part of. And it just so happened that they found my episode and they were like, wait, you didn't tell me that you were on the episode? I was like, because I don't care. Like, I think these brothers are doing something amazing and something good.
Oh, shit.
And then I started to get random messages about, hey, you have a diverse collection of books. Like, hey, like, what would you suggest for me for this? What would you suggest for me for this? But then I can't lie, guys, I'm kind of provocative as well with my excoriation of religion. But that's how I met another individual that, that I told you about earlier, was like, hey, here's why I think the way I think. I'll give you some book recommendations that led me kind of down that vein of thinking. I would love to get some recommendations on why you believe the way you believe. And I want some books from you. But I'm thankful for it, because just over the last, literally over the last month and a half, 2 months or whatnot. And my wife said the same thing too. She was like, there's so many people hopping in your DMs. There's so many people like friending you and asking for book recommendations. And, you know, my wife was like, how many of them women? But I thought it was beautiful, because all I really wanted to do was just like be able to talk to people about books and understand, like, hey, there's people still read. Yep. People still have the hard copy.
Surprise. Yeah, we didn't know.
We didn't know either, but we thought we were alone. That is what
we really did.
It's like, right, as soon as you start putting yourself out there in any way, like, folks will come to you, like, you know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah, for real. That's it, bro.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Booked Up Like podcast. Be sure to check out Travis's Instagram at Let Us Talk Books. And of course, give us a rating and a review on Apple Music if you're listening to our podcast there. Thank you again, and we'll catch you next time.